I'm Chris Olds. I'm a professor in the geography department, and I'm going to just do a very brief introduction. Some people like to give the half lecture introductions to speakers, and I'm going to go for the short end of the spectrum here. And we're very pleased to welcome Ronald Numbers to the geography department. Is this your first geography seminar since you've been teaching in Madison? One of the pleasures of working at a big university is that there's so much going on, and one of the problems, to be honest, is that there is so much going on you never know or you never have a chance to connect with people. If we were in a smaller place, Professor Numbers would probably be cross-appointed with our department. In a big place like this, it's taken many years to finally to get him here into the geography department. And the context in which today's talk is taking place is actually quite a fertile one. There's a fairly large number of initiatives going on, in particular in England, but also in Ireland, in the United States and Canada, connections being made between sort of history of science, STS, and geography, cultural, historical geography, urban geographies, economic geographies, and so on. And so the context is actually a lot of interdisciplinary connections being forged right now. And in that sort of context, actually, it's great to welcome our guest speaker here today. Professor Ronald Numbers is the Hilldale Professor in the History of Science and Medicine and of Religious Studies. And a member of the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at UW-Madison as well. And he's been involved in writing and editing a whole series of books. And I'll just say a few of the titles just so you can sort of get the gist of his approach. When Science and Christianity Meet, The Creationists, From Scientific Creationism to Intelligent Design, Science and Christianity in Pulpit and Pew. He's editing an 8-volume history of science with Cambridge University Press, one of them with David Livingston, the well-known geographer based at Queen's University in Belfast, actually. So for the Geog Thought students in here who are doing, in particular, the human geography preliminary exam, that's one of the, I think, connections that you have to make. And a whole series of books, actually a very prolific writer, editor, contributor, editor of journals, etc., and a member of a whole variety of different associations and organizations. And I don't want to run through them all because it'll take forever, but also eat into the time. So I'd rather pass it over right now to Professor Numbers to give a talk on Creationism Goes Global, Changing Geographies of Creationism and Intelligent Design. The talk will go on, and then Professor Numbers will field the questions. I'll pass it over now to Professor Numbers, and welcome you to the geography department.
Thank you. Well, it's an honor to be invited to give one of the lectures in the series named after our distinguished colleague, Yifu Tuan, and I'm delighted to be here. I was a little nonplussed when I first received the invitation because not only am I not a geographer, I have no idea what geography is. I was pretty good with capitals and countries when I was in elementary school, but nobody seems to be doing that anymore. As was pointed out, I've been collaborating with a good friend of mine, David Livingstone, who professes to be a geographer and holds a chair in geography, but he and I do exactly the same thing. The only difference I've ever been able to notice over the years is that he sometimes uses the word place where I would talk about idea or something. But we both do the history of science and religion in the 19th and 20th centuries. So maybe I am a geographer and just haven't discovered it. You can let me know after this. There's probably no topic in the history of science and religion that is more place specific than creationism. For years before he passed away, when he was traveling around the world, Stephen Jay Gould used to like to assure people outside of the United States that as insidious as creationism may seem, at least it's not a worldwide phenomenon. I hope everybody realizes the extent to which this is a local, indigenous, American bizarrity. His colleague, Richard Lewontin, also at Harvard, made much the same claim. A little more geographically specific, however. He said in the early 1980s, creationism is an American institution. And it's not only American, but specifically Southern and Southwestern. It's good to marginalize things like that. What I want to do this afternoon is to look at its roots in the United States. Clearly, this movement originated here. But then to trace the ways in which it has traveled around the world into most areas. Except, for example, not doing well, has never done well, in Southern Asia, where the Hindus have not really taken up with this, although they sometimes, Hindu quasi-creationists sometimes dismiss Charles Darwin as a rascal who should not be paid much attention to. And the other part of the globe where there's very little interest is sub-Saharan Africa. The reason there seems to be that there are not enough evolutionists to mount a creationist movement. Nobody sees any need to do it there. That's one reason. Another reason is the obvious racial implications of the teaching that humans emerged from monkeys or apes, which is not a very attractive feature of Darwinism down there. But as I hope to show this afternoon, creationism and its variant intelligent design have managed to do rather well in the world in the last few years. Being a historian, let me go back to the early part of the 20th century, specifically to the 1920s. Everybody here, I'm sure, knows about the anti-evolution movement in the 20s that did not culminate in the Scopes Trial. Actually, it picked up steam with the Scopes Trial and didn't end until later in the 1920s. But because it seemed to center on southern states, and especially on the town of Dayton, Tennessee, the creationist movement of that time became known as a southern phenomenon. And Tennessee became a byword around the world. I've looked at newspaper coverage of this trial in various parts of the world, and Tennessee came to represent everything that was backward and ignorant. And yes, I am from Tennessee. Now, a couple of facts. One is most states discussed and refused to pass most southern states refused to pass anti-evolution laws. There were really only three laws that made the teaching of human evolution illegal. A couple other laws were critical of evolution but didn't make it illegal. And even in the 1920s, the leadership of the movement tended to come from outside of the southern region. Bryan himself was from Nebraska and Washington, D.C. William Bell Riley, the founder and leader of the World's Christian Fundamentalist Association. The organization that brought Brian to Dayton, Tennessee, was a Baptist preacher in the Twin Cities. John Roach Straighten, one of the most outspoken anti-evolutionists of the time, was a minister in New York City. Eugene Rimmer. That's my brother-in-law's name. The Reverend Rimmer was headquartered in Los Angeles, California. You could go on and on. There were very few of the anti-evolutionist leaders in the South. Many states discussed passing anti-evolution laws. One outside the South that probably came the closest to doing so was Minnesota, where you had a lot of anti-evolutionist Lutherans. But the Lutherans seemed to fear any intrusion of the state more than the Darwinists. And so in the end, they refused to vote for a law, much to the distress of William Bell Riley, the Baptist preacher there. Very little about the anti-evolution campaign of the 1920s corresponds to what we know to be true. It's almost predictable that in an American history text, whether high school or college text, you'll see the anti-evolution movement paired with the prohibition movement as examples of a anti-urban force at work in American culture. We don't know much about the social bases of the anti-evolution movement, except for one state. Arkansas actually held a referendum on this issue, and surprise, the people from the urban areas supported the law more than the people from the rural areas. Now, some of you are probably snickering and saying, "What? In 1920s, were there any urban areas in Arkansas?" Even Little Rock could be considered, if you wanted to, I guess, a rural area back then, but that would be wrong. There was very little effort and even less success in taking this movement outside the United States. One of the most active of the anti-evolutionists was a Canadian from the Maritime Provinces named George McCready Price, who was described by the journal Science in the mid-1920s as the leading scientific authority of the creationist movement. He had an honorary bachelor's degree and an honorary master's degree. He was what we would call an armchair and self-trained scientist. And in the mid-1920s, he happened to be teaching for a few years at a church college outside of London and would make his way into the city to try to spread the anti-evolution message. And even the conservatives there in the Victoria Society, where you would have found the most anti-evolution people in Great Britain, said to him, and the discussions are actually printed in their proceedings, "We don't want you coming over and disturbing the peace over here in England. You know, that's something that we don't want to have anything to do with." Now, during the 1920s and 30s, in fact, up until the 1960s, creationism was very unlike what we know today. Despite what you may have seen in the movie Inherit the Wind, William Jennings Bryan and William Bell Riley and the other leaders of the movement, with the exception of this Canadian Price, warmly accepted the evidence of the antiquity of life on Earth, either by interpreting the days of creation to be long geological periods, or assuming that there was a huge gap between Genesis 1 and Genesis 3 in which you could slip the entire geological column. The advocates of what came to be known as young earth creationism were on the margins of the anti-evolution movement. If I don't know why textbooks still get Brian wrong. The proceedings of the trial, the transcript of the trial, were published by the end of 1925 and have been widely available. And in the one pertinent exchange, Darrow, the agnostic, godless attorney, trying to embarrass Brian, asks him about the days of creation, assuming, I think, that he's going to say, oh, 24-hour solar days. And Brian finally, in frustration, there's a little back and forth, finally in frustration says, we don't care how long the days are. It makes no difference. They could be 6 days. They could be 6,000 years. They could be 600,000 years or 600 million years. It doesn't make any difference to us. And that was true for him and for many, if not most, of the anti-evolutionists during that time. When the movement against evolution broke out again in the 1960s, it had a very different feel and very different content. Because the leaders of this resurgence were, by and large, young Earth creationists. People who wanted to fit the entire history of life on Earth into about 6,000 years, and many of whom wanted to fit the entire history of the universe into 6 or 10,000 years. This was something new. In 1970, plus or minus a year, they renamed the old creationism scientific creationism, or creation science. And the way you can spot that almost invariably is that a scientific creationist emphasizes the work of Noah's flood. The reason why so many creationists in the first half of the 20th century had accepted the antiquity of life on Earth was because of the geological, paleontological record. So you had to do something. That was the most glaring evidence of the extent of life on Earth. The young Earth creationist said, we have a solution. We will squeeze the entire geological column into the year of Noah's flood. That takes care of it. The evolutionists no longer have time for evolution to work. The Bible is literally accurate on this point. So that's how you can tell a creation scientist from an old Earth creationist by the role assigned to Noah's flood. Once again, this 60s movement broke out, by the way, with the publication of a book in 1961 by two card-carrying fundamentalists, an Old Testament scholar named John Whitcomb and a hydraulic engineer named Henry Morris, both of whom were very bright and well-educated. Whitcomb had attended Princeton University. Morris had a PhD from the University of Minnesota and had gone on to head up the large civil engineering department at Virginia Tech. And in 1961, they brought out an updated version of George McCready Price's Young Earth Creationism to great acclaim in fundamentalist and evangelical circles. And then 2 years after the book came out, 10 Young Earth creationists, largely young Earth, they were all supposed to be young Earth creationists, but there were a couple of ringers in there, organized the Creation Research Society, which became the primary organization for anti-evolutionists during this time. Now, once again, in terms of place, this had little to do with the South. Of the 10 founders of this, the leader, Walter Lammerts, had a PhD in genetics from the University of California at Berkeley and had subsequently taught at UCLA, lived in California. only one of the ten founders, Morris, lived in the South at Virginia Tech. There were four or five from Michigan, one from Arizona, one from Missouri. So this was not in any way a peculiarly Southern movement. Now, it is true that in the early 1980s, two states passed laws mandating that creation science be taught anytime evolution science was taught, and they were both in the South, in Arkansas and Louisiana. In the late 1990s, there emerged a new variant of anti-evolutionism called intelligent design. Despite a few connections with the scientific creation movement, there are many more dissimilarities. The intelligent design people do not want to talk about the Bible, whereas the creation scientists insisted on starting with the Bible and then fitting science into that model. They want to create a big tent of critics, and most scarily of all, they want to change the fundamental rule for doing science. That is, if you provide a scientific explanation, it must be natural. And they say, but that's wrong. What if you find evidence of God? Why would it be wrong to say so if you're a scientist? So they want to change a 200-year-old rule for practicing science and reintroducing the idea that supernatural explanations, when warranted by the evidence, they would say, should count as proper science. Now, they focus their attack on evolution, but they have this larger resacralization project in mind. Well, they'd like to resacralize all of culture, too. But they're going to start with science just for beginners. Those of you who have been keeping up with the news the last decade or so know that this, too, has not been distinctive to the South. There was the first and only significant trial so far was held in Pennsylvania, which is kind of like the South, I think, in some ways. And we even find outbreaks of creationism, intelligent design in states as remote as Alaska, for goodness sake. I've been reading a lot about that lately, and it's very, very confusing. Okay, so let me just sum up what's happened in the United States and then move on to see how the rest of the world has been influenced by this movement. Since the early 1980s, the Gallup organization has been polling Americans on their views. About every 2 years, we get a new one coming out. And for 25 years or more, there has been a relatively stable response between 43 and 47% of Americans profess to believe that the first human beings are no older than 10,000 years. Now, that's a stand-in question for, are you a creationist or an evolutionist? They don't go on to ask, usually, whether you're a young earth creationist or an old earth creationist or an intelligent design theorist. Recently, they asked a different question. This was 2 or 3 years ago. Do you think that creationism is definitely or probably correct? And 65.5% of Americans, over half the college graduates, so you can't just say it's a bunch of rednecks from the South doing this, said they believed that creationism, whatever they meant by that term, creationism was probably or definitely true. So there is a huge reservoir of support in American culture for people who challenge evolution. Politically, it's not unpopular. It might be scary to some of us in here to have our leading politicians, McCain, for example, thinks that all any theory should be taught in science courses. I kind of like Joe Biden's response the best. I think he was on the Jon Stewart show, and he was asked about intelligent design, and he, in his typical way, said, "It's malarkey." He'll probably lose. So, why, if you believe me and not Stephen Jay Gould, why has this swept around the world, at least in the Northern Hemisphere and in, to a great extent, in South America? The short answer is largely through the missionary efforts of North American, particularly U.S., creationists, who since the 70s and early 80s have been circling the globe promoting these views and finding receptive audiences. Let me just go through geographically, if you will. I'm trying really hard to make this fit into the series. Canada, South America, Europe, and we'll go on from there. Okay, so you may be inundated with data, but I think data will be the only thing that will convince you of my claims. What about in Canada? Canada seems to be a very laid-back country. Not so much excitement about religion. Probably only about a third of Canadians attend church regularly, significantly down from the United States. For years, all we had from Canada were impressions. But finally, Maclean's magazine hired a polling company to find out what Canadians believed. And at a time when I believe 47% of Americans professed to believe that the first humans were created no more than 10,000 years ago, 53% of Canadians said they believed that humans were no older than 6 to 10,000 years old. The creationist movement up there first attracted national attention when it was discovered in the early 1990s that a school, public school in British Columbia, was actually teaching creationism and had been teaching it for a number of years. And it finally took the intervention of the British Columbia Ministry of Education to put a stop to this. In 2000, some of you may remember that one of the two finalists for Premier of Canada was an Alberta lay preacher named Stockwell Day, a Pentecostal. Pentecostals are doing well in Alaska and northern Canada, I think, who was a young earth creationist. He did lose. Very interesting because of the parallels with Sarah Palin in the last couple of weeks about whether we should talk publicly about privately held religious views. And Day's opponent in the election was a Roman Catholic named Jean Chrétien. And he says, hey, none of you reporters ever ask him whether he believes in transubstantiation or the Immaculate Conception. Why should you ask me about my religious views? You know, and I think we're getting a very similar type of response in this election, that maybe people's the more peculiar a person's religious views are, the more maybe off base others think they should be. So we've lost Canada. Okay, this is a little partisan, isn't it? I'm just a historian. I'm neutral. I don't care who wins this debate. Predominantly Catholic countries never responded that warmly or positively to Darwinism, but they never got worked up over it very much either. And so South America was rather immune to the inroads of the creationists until very late in the 20th century when, as some of you know, the Pentecostals just swept through Central and South America and converted masses of people, along with the Seventh-day Adventists, the Church of George McCready Price, who bequeathed young earth creationism to us. The Institute for Creation Research, which was founded in 1972, has had radio programs targeted to Latin America. They've been about 600 stations have been carrying their short little creationist messages regularly for years and years. As I say, in the 1990s, the interest in creationism, to use the language of the evangelists down there, exploded. Let me give you one example, Brazil. Polls in Brazil show that 31% of Brazilians believe the first humans were younger than 10,000 years. Creationism is sufficiently active there that they support two anti-evolution societies in Brazil. And in 2000, the evangelical, read Pentecostal, governor of the state of Rio hired hundreds of teachers to bring creationism into the curriculum. It was non-mandated, it wasn't required, but it was made available to the school children in Rio. Now, a few evolutionists in Brazil got up in arms about this and tried to stop it, but got no support whatsoever. I've corresponded with one of the leaders about this, and two or three got agitated, and the rest said, forget it. So there's been not much of an organized response from the scientific community to the inroads in Brazil anyway. No country in the world has been more active in promoting the anti-evolution movement than Australia. Now, maybe there's no country in the world as close to America as Australia. This is always one of the big problems when the Americans try to spread their message. Critics say, oh, that's an American thing. Don't try to push Americanism on us. So in Australia and many other places, the proponents of creationism go out of their way to insist that, no, what we're promoting is not American. We have twisted it just a little bit so that it doesn't sound too American. It really is, for all practical purposes, the same. Queensland, which is often described as the Texas of Australia, has become a center over the years for the anti-evolution movement. For a period back in the late 20th century, both the Prime Minister and the Minister of Education were active proponents of creationism. There they have no constitutional constraints that would prohibit the teaching of religious ideas in the public schools. And in typical Aussie fashion, the people down there have become more aggressive. Debates down there are sometimes get out of hand. I love the one when the Australian geologist, when Dwayne Gish, some of you may have heard, he was here on campus a couple decades ago, famous creationist debater went down there, and one of the evolutionist geologists said, you know, you don't believe in science, and so he plugged a cord into the wall. He had insulated gloves on himself, the geologist, and said, hey, take this, and instead of debating, just ridiculed the creationist, and then at the end started suggesting all sorts of sexual irregularities. I mean, things get pretty rough up here, but they don't get quite like that. In 1980, the creationist in Australia, in Queensland, you might guess, just outside of Brisbane, founded the Creation Science Foundation, which became the headquarters for the creationist movement in the South Pacific, spawning groups in New Zealand and other places. They attract, well, one of the founders of the Creation Science Foundation was a former science teacher, high school science teacher named Ken Ham, who is a fantastic public speaker, an entertainer. I don't know if any of you have ever heard him, but sometimes you can catch him on various forums, who became so successful, he then moved to the United States to the Institute for Creation Research, and then in the late 90s moved to Northern Kentucky, just outside Cincinnati, where he set up Answers in Genesis. Now, he does believe in the arguments for scientific creationism, but he clearly doesn't mind identifying creationism with Genesis and the Bible. He is now the rock star of the creationist movement, and some of you may know that just within the last year or so, he opened a $27 million state-of-the-art creation museum outside of Cincinnati, recruiting somebody who had done a lot of the work at Disneyland to come out and help. And so you can check this out anytime you're driving back across the country to the east. And he now has branches scattered all around the world promoting this. I mentioned New Zealand. New Zealand is peculiar. They pride themselves on being one of the most secular places on the face of the earth. But in the last few years, since the creationists have been moving in down there, both sides agree that at least 5% of Kiwis are now active creationists. The school board for Auckland, by far the largest city in New Zealand, actually turned out a guide for teachers advocating the two-model approach, creation science, evolution science. A lot of the support in New Zealand is coming from the Pacific Islanders and the Maoris, who seem to be very, very Christian, number one, and very skeptical about Darwinism. And so that's one pillar of support there. The other is the homeschool movement has prospered in New Zealand, and many of those people are using teaching tools that promote creationism instead of evolution. There wasn't a lot of enthusiasm for anti-evolution, as I mentioned, in Great Britain until recently. In mid-1930s, the British did start a small society, the Evolution Protest Movement, which became in the 80s affiliated with the Young Earth Creation Movement. But if you talk to most Brits, they'll say, you know, it's not a big problem over here. Well, they've started taking polls in Britain too. 2006 was the first broad-scale poll that I've been able to discover. A minority of the British people believe in evolution, 48%. 22% say they're creationists. 17% say they subscribe to intelligent design. I'm not sure they'd know the difference, but, and 13% are just confused. But in the home of Charles Darwin, where there hasn't been much of an active movement, now you have a minority of the adults saying that they believe in evolution. The creationists first came to public prominence in Great Britain in 2002 when it was discovered that a semi-public, semi-private college, this was equivalent to our high schools, technical school, had rented out its facilities to Ken Ham to give a weekend series of anti-evolution lectures. It turned out that the principal and the head of science in that school were also anti-evolutionists, and that the school had been funded, the private part of this school had been funded, by a recently knighted car dealer who was a fundamentalist Christian and was providing funds for more such schools, and was enthusiastically backed by Tony Blair, who was then promptly accused of once again foolishly following the Americans. Britons from Richard Dawkins on the left to John Polkinghorne on the right came together to denounce this travesty. The creationists loved it because they hadn't been getting any attention. And they said, isn't it wonderful, providential, how now God's enemies are getting us in the news? This has continued to be a troublesome issue in Great Britain. It's especially problematic in the growing Islamic community there. Where many of the children, when they go to school, resist being taught evolution, and then the still small, but I think growing evangelical community over there. Some of you may have picked up that just within the last few days, there's been a scandal in the Royal Society over creationism. I don't know how many of you know about this. A recent president of the Royal Society gave in his farewell message a warning to beware of creationism coming in. And just this last week or so, two Nobel laureates who were fellows of the Royal Society discovered that the head of education for the Royal Society was an Anglican minister who had said, look, when it comes up in the classroom, we should go ahead and talk about it. Doesn't seem like too wild an idea. But they forced him finally to resign. I mean, Richard Dawkins, as usual, had one of the pithiest comments on this. He says, "Can you know, it reminds me of a Monty Python skit to have a preacher being head of education for the most distinguished scientific society in the world." I'm going to have to travel faster, right? Okay. The recent polls have been conducted throughout Europe and show that there is a strong base of about 20% of creationists in Europe. And in several countries, the anti-evolution sentiment has broken out in surprising ways. In the Netherlands, for example, just a few years ago, the Minister of Science and Education proposed that in order to bring peace to the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim communities, the public school should start teaching intelligent design, because that was one thing they could all agree on, which led to some people writing, in fact, in the journal Science, saying, is Holland becoming the Kansas of Europe? Maybe so. Denmark has had problems. In Italy, there has been growing support for creationism. And in 2004, one of the parties, the National Alliance, dismissed evolution as a fairy tale and linked it to Marxism. The same year, the Minister of Education shocked the Italian nation by calling for the deletion of evolution from high school textbooks. Now, unlike in Brazil, the Italian scientists rose up almost as one. There were mass demonstrations in the streets there that led to a quick rescinding of this. I could talk about Eastern Europe and Serbia and other countries, but let me just use Russia as an example. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the Ministry of Education for the Russian Federation began inviting young Earth creationists to come over and give seminars and help write textbooks, because they wanted to promote freedom of choice and tolerance. For decades, the communist bureaucracy had permitted only one line, largely the Lysenko line. And now that they were free, they wanted to be sure that they were able to enjoy their intellectual freedom. Also, as most of us probably know, Russia has seen a huge influx of evangelical Christians proselytizing there, and creationism has come along with that as well. In Asia, the powerhouse of the creationist movement has turned out to be South Korea. Following a visit of the American leaders of the creationist movement about 1980, they formed a society, the Korea Creation Science Association, and have been immensely successful. Thousands of meetings per year they hold. They have become so enthusiastic that they have started in recent years to send missionaries to the west coast of North America and to Indonesia. I think it's a bigger challenge in Indonesia, okay. Clearly, so far, creationism has spread almost exclusively, in what I've said, to other Christian cultures. Not just Protestants and evangelicals, but in some areas Catholic, in some areas Eastern Orthodox as well. But the one area that nobody expected it to go into was the non-Christian world. And let me close with two examples, and then we can have a discussion. In the mid-1980s, the Ministry of Education for the largely Islamic country of Turkey, though officially secular, began inviting young Earth creationists to come over and help prepare textbooks and other curricular materials for combating evolution, godless Marxist evolution, in the public schools, which these people did. They had already started going over to Turkey in search of Noah's Ark, so some of them had had experience in going over there. About 1990, a very small group of young Turks, I didn't mean that as a pun, actually, when I, but as soon as it came out of my mouth, I knew I who were followers of a charismatic imam named Adnan Oktar, who called himself Harun Yahya, formed something called the Science Research Foundation, the acronym for which is BAV, which makes sense, I'm sure. Oktar, or Harun Yahya, and his inner circle began churning out anti-evolution books by the dozens. One of the most widely circulated, easily in the millions, one estimate says 8 million, was The Evolution Deceit. Early on, he would work anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial into his works. Then when he got criticized for that, he said, no, I love Jews, I don't like Zionists. So they've moderated somewhat over the years. But he has developed an international movement. Wherever you find significant Islamic communities, you are almost certainly going to find traces of Harun Yahya's influence. He's been in prison twice, and he's just recently been sentenced to a third prison term. It's unclear. I've tried my best to find out exactly what the charges are. It's not for promoting creationism. He's being charged by the government, the military behind the government, I'm sure, with running some sort of a crime-type syndicate because he takes money from his followers or forces them to give money would be probably the allegation. Now, Muslims don't need to believe in a young earth or in a worldwide flood. But Harun Yahya, for a number of years, because he was getting most of his support from young earth creationists in America, incorporated those arguments into his writings. When the intelligent design movement came along, that much more clearly fit what Muslims would like. And so they moved over to that, and within a short period, the Discovery Institute, I have to watch out that I don't say Institute for Discovery, because some people get mad at me. The Discovery Institute in Seattle identified that as the Islamic Intelligent Design website. About the same time, Harun Yahya damned intelligent design. It turned out that one of his star disciples, who speaks English very well, had become so prominent an advocate of intelligent design that he had been invited to Kansas to testify in favor of teaching intelligent design and creationism, or against evolution, in the school curriculum. And this thoroughly annoyed Harun Yahya, who didn't want any of his disciples to have any prominence. And so he put on his website, the Islamic ID website, a screed against ID, saying that no Muslim could possibly endorse intelligent design unless they say it leads to Allah, that this is anti-Muslim and must be rejected. Finally, this has come to some segments of the Jewish community. Although there have been many Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews who did not accept evolution, until very recently, most Jews did not engage in any scientific discussion of the evidence against evolution or for creationism. That changed significantly in 2000 when a group of largely Israeli and American Jews came together to create the Torah Science Foundation. Now, as we've seen in other countries, where the first thing you have to do is try to show that you're not just adopting American-style creationism, these people have been forced from the beginning to insist that they're not just importing Christian or Protestant-style anti-evolutionism. And in some ways, they've escaped it by mixing in not quite equal parts of Kabbalah with young earth creationism to get something that looks to people like me very much like what fundamentalist Protestants have been advocating for years. Okay. I hope you'll agree with me that this movement, or these movements, if we distinguish, say, between creationism and intelligent design, have done very well globally in the last 10 or 15 years. And I know that some of you may want me to explain why. In anticipation of that, I thought, well, what would my friend David Livingstone say as a geographer? And he would say, it varies place to place. And I can't think of a better answer myself. Thank you.
We'll let Professor Numbers field questions himself. So if you don't mind, make sure you shout loud if you're way in the back.
Yeah, I'll turn the question around then.
Yeah.
Why is it that evolution and the understanding of evolution have not proliferated to the degree that something like intelligent design has? Is it because of the fact that ID or the ideas surrounding that are much simpler to grasp onto as opposed to evolutionary theory?
It's an excellent question, and I don't think that there's any simple answer. People near and dear to me know that I think that one of the problems is the teaching of evolution. I don't think it's taught well in this country especially. Students graduate from this university not knowing the arguments for evolution, and then we wonder why they don't think it's true. I mean, the argument for evolution in this country seems to be mostly an argument from authority. It is true, rather than trying to explain. So I have been urging for years that the universities start a large general education course to introduce students who aren't going on in biology to expose them to the evidence. But that's only a small part of it. I don't think education could cure this. The primary motive behind both the creationist intelligent design movements is religious. And as long as people feel that evolution contradicts the Bible on the one hand, or contradicts the evidence for God's existence and activity, then they're going to be suspicious of it. Surprisingly, most of the opponents don't see themselves as anti-scientific in any way. They see the evolutionists as betraying science. This is a speculative theory. It's tied up in some places with, you know, communism or Marxism or the Democratic Party or some, you know, something really weird. And they don't have anything to do with it. So I think that is probably an even bigger reason. And then in some places, I think it may actually, like in the Islamic world, they associate the critics of evolution associate Darwinism with sort of Western materialism and decadence, and so it gets tied up in that kind of package.
Yeah, I'm assuming you're familiar with the book 40 Days and 40 Nights about
written
the...
By Noah.
I think it's Darwin's great-grandson. He
covered the trial
in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And he comes to the conclusion that he thinks maybe creationism should be taught alongside alongside evolution, and that people would clearly see if they were placed right next to each other that he trusts that they would, that evolution would naturally, win.
Yeah, right.
I mean, but what do you think about that argument of for teaching creationism?
Okay, I'm an American. I believe in the constitutional separation of church and state here. So my answer is applicable only to the United States. I do think that many elementary and high school teachers have become so scared that they think they're violating the Constitution if they answer questions about this. I think that's wrong. I tend to agree with the guy who just lost his job at the Memorial Society that if a student raises a question, what better opportunity is there to say, look, here's the evidence for evolution, and it doesn't square with the claims for creationism. And there, I think there's no court in the country that would say that that violated the separation of church and state. Now, many of the people who are advocating this, the teaching of creationism or intelligent design alongside of evolution, are insisting that it be done in the science classroom. Nobody cares whether historians or religious educators teach about creation science, although if you got too enthusiastic about it, you'd probably get your hands slapped. But it's teaching it as science, which both the creation scientists and the intelligent design people who are insisting that their view is science and not natural theology want. That's the goal. And, of course, regardless of some of the critics of science in our culture, science still has huge cultural authority. And they know that. And they know that their critique of evolution is not going to be taken seriously by certain groups of people, maybe even students, unless it can be taught as science. And now that's where I would go to the streets myself there. Yes?
Why is the rate of biodiversity in the Amazon basin?
I'm sorry, in the Amazon basin?
Siberian tundra.
Could you repeat that, please? I missed it.
Why is there greater biodiversity in the Amazon basin than in the Siberian tundra?
Oh, because of evolution. Yes.
Yes. Just a general comment. When you were talking about that poll, why people would subscribe to the idea of creationism over evolution, I think a lot of it is people really don't know that much about either one. So by default, they think, well, I'm going to vote for God because what if I'm wrong? I don't want to tell or something. It's kind of like when, I don't know much about finances, and when my wife tells me I need to stop spending money, I say yes, dear, because I don't want to get in trouble. So I think it's the same thing why so many people would go along with creationism.
I'll share an anecdote with you. I think a lot of people don't know much about this, I had this demonstrated graphically a few years ago. I was flying back from an intelligent design conference in Waco, Texas, and my seatmate was a businessman, an engineer actually, with a master's degree from Milwaukee, who was reading two intelligent design books. And I thought, well, maybe he'd been at the conference, so I struck up a conversation with him. And no, he didn't know about the conference, and so I acted dumb, and I said, well, what are the ideas in this book? And he said, well, the fossils were buried during Noah's Ark. Now, these intelligent design books never said a word about Noah's flood. That's not part of what they teach. That's young earth creationism. But he knew the books. Here's my explanation. He knew the books were critical of evolution. And he kind of knew that a lot of anti-evolutionists attributed the fossils to Noah's flood. So he was reading that right into the books and telling me that's what he was reading when I know, I've read the books myself, there's nothing like that. Professor Twine.
I would surmise that college students believe in intelligent design. Why? Because they're professors are so intelligent and their courses all show design.
Well, I love that answer.
They are baffled a bit about the evolution they learn in biology classes because every day they confront data which they believe be true, namely professors show intelligence and their courses show design. But the evolution courses never explain that. It never really comes down to explaining this phenomenon, namely someone who shows intelligence and his work shows design.
Does that mean I should be concerned if my students think I'm godlike?
I was going to pose my question another way.
Oh, okay.
I meant it as a compliment, but I was thinking that in my later years teaching, sometimes I feel unhappy at the end of a class because I felt, look, what have I said? I've offered the class a succession of random thoughts loosely linked together. And I said, a biologist can probably explain that, what I presented. Random thoughts loosely connected, as against my more better prepared colleagues, such as Wrong Number, who can give a lecture that is not a succession of random thoughts loosely linked together, but that clearly shows intelligence and design. How would a biology course explain that, as distinct from explaining something easier, like my random thoughts?
Are there any zoologists here in the audience who might be able to answer that question for us?
Don't try to plug it off on me, pal.
Oh, gee! Providentially, we have a zoologist. I don't think she's going to rise to the occasion, I'm sorry to say. Peter?
I was wondering whether the surmise about Harun Yahya, and we all wondered where he's getting some money. He's reading these very fancy produced books and sending them to people all over the place. Has it now been determined that he got his money through criminal enterprises? That would be very interesting.
Well, that's been the allegation for years by his opponent. He says that these are you know, free will. So it's hard to know. I mean, he's fighting against a nasty group. Let's put it that way. I don't trust either side very much to play fair. His critics have accused him of they have, he says, planted drugs in his home. They have accused him of consorting with prostitutes. Pictures have appeared in the newspapers. In fact, he gave me one when I visited him. You know, I was trying to be very discreet. If you think I could get a Xerox copy, oh, take it with you. Of course, I can't read anything that goes with the picture, but it's an attractive picture. And he says this is what they do to men of God to try to break them down. And I've remained fairly friendly with the breakaway ID guy, who has never said that there was any illegality going on. And he's been fairly candid about the problem there. Hear him? Oh, and then, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, 2 points. One, just an observation. That is, I'm not sure we should discuss Africa. I was teaching in the early 1960s in a primary school and had enormous difficulty teaching evolution. This was amongst a largely where Christian missions were prominent. Christian missionaries came into the schools to teach. The Catholic priest who in a previous life had been a geologist, when I asked him, "Cook, well, can you explain that this is okay?" He said, "Well, no, I don't want to confuse them." So they were getting a simplistic Christian message, and of course today there's a massive outpouring of Pentecostalism and Western evangelical activity in Africa. So I think there is more there. But the question that...
But having talked to some of these people, they imply or say that it's hard to get people aroused because the creationists are in the majority, and you need to be oppressed to get a movement, an insurgent movement going there.
That's the point. Movement that you scan right. elsewhere, but I think it's probably a majority of the people in Africa who believe this. But the second question, though, is if creationism has now moved beyond sort of fundamentalist Christian communities, what do you attribute its intellectual appeal or its emotional appeal in the spreading to Jewish, to Muslim communities where there is no basis in the Quran, there is no basis in the Torah for these kinds of ideas?
Well, one can find a basis in the Quran and in the Torah for defending something like this, in the Torah for defending a very recent creation. And I think my impression is virtually all of the ultra-Orthodox and many Orthodox have always thought that it was a young earth, but as I say, didn't think that there was any need to engage in a scientific discussion of this. And now you have some Jewish scientists who are saying, look, you know, there are arguments for this. The head of the Torah Science Foundation is a biologist at UCLA. A number of the most prominent people have training in biology and the other sciences, and why they feel the need, I'm not sure, except that it could have to do with the authority of science. You know, you tell young people, look, we don't believe the earth is more than this because of the Torah, but if you can also get evidence from science, I mean, one of the most popular Jewish books against evolution was by a Hopkins-trained scientist called Not by Chance. And it just recycles a lot of the anti-evolution arguments. But the idea is, you know, it's all too complex to be by chance. And I think that resonates with a lot of people. Even on my, you know, some of my worst days, I think, boy, am I an accident?
With these Gallup polls you were mentioning, say 43-47% of Americans believe that humans are about 10,000 years old or so, I was wondering your impressions of sort of the reliability of these, because the thing that comes to mind is, you know, a pollster comes up to you and asks you about this or on the phone or whatever, and you say, well, you know, I'm a good Bible-believing Christian, and there's still a sort of social pressure to say, well, of course I believe that. You may have never opened a Bible or set foot in a church ever in your life.
I've thought about this, and I share some of your skepticism about the accuracy of polls, especially the ones that show that 53% of the people responding believe in scientific evolution, and 54% are hardcore creationists. It raises some questions. And some of them do that. You know, I mean, it's kind of strange. On the other hand, what are we left with? When I started out as a young historian, people I knew often generalized on the basis of an N of 3 or 4. You know, and they didn't get criticized as much as pollsters get criticized for being inaccurate. I feel much more comfortable with the Gallup organization doing, I don't know if it's scientific or not, but they say it's scientific, so I'll accept that. Scientific polls and finding out, and they've been so stable over the years that increases my confidence. And maybe I'm foolish to believe that, but then you look at elections and things like that, you know, it's probably true. Yeah.
So, just returning to the IA for a moment, you didn't mention the big red anti-evolution book that I presume you received a copy.
Yeah, The Atlas of Evolution.
Yeah.
By Haroun Yahya. Yeah, you notice I was down to my last 5 minutes and I couldn't do it.
But it's for the folks who might not be familiar, it's this endless tale. It's beautifully produced and huge, 500 pages glossy with a series of fossils or other evidence, insects trapped in amber, that are dated by archaeologists. juxtaposed against photographs of modern organisms that are essentially unchanged. And every page ends up, see, evolution can't be true. Except I think, I can't remember what the page number is, but in the case of the caddisfly, he shows this, I think it's, first it's trapped in amber for the ancients, and then it shows a picture of the modern one. Well, if you're a trout fisherman, you know that the caddisfly is used widely in trout fishing. Well, this particular picture of a caddisfly has a barbed hook. You know, what are you going to do?
I really enjoy your talk, and I do have something I want to some clarification, so allow me to understand your argument much better. Certainly I'm not debating your argument, but there is a movement up there. So I'm going back to the polls, and one of the analogies you made of the creationism, and also the people believe that humans were created last 10,000 years or something like that. So to me, that could mislead people. If, and I was when I was actually first started my career, I was a biogeographer. So I happened to study a little bit of evolutionary theory, things like that, look at the flowers, how they evolve, make connections, things like that. But if some poll showed me like this, okay, so you believe human was created 10,000 within last 10,000 years, I'm most likely to check yes. The reason that most information, the archaeology, the human, the anthropologists, or whatever they're doing, say that dating back, say we're on so many years. So that could be misleading. So the analogy made between creationism and also people believing like a human was created in the last 10,000 years. So as an analogy, was it, I'm kind of confused here. So because that could have mislead people to believe, to prove the result, because you didn't mention that people like me are perfectly evolutionist, right? Believer, but could be too that. So, were there any other thing on the poster that most more than that, more important? Is that the most important criteria for
well, for Gallup? No, I've been very frustrated because that tells you nothing about the distinctions between old Earth and young Earth creationists, because many, if not most, old Earth creationists believe that the whole geological column preceded the Edenic creation, which was no more than 10,000 years old. So they would say yes to that question, but they would also see themselves as creationists. So in a generic sense, I think you're catching the anti-evolutionist here. I have to go next with my host here.
Okay. Yeah. I'm actually from British Columbia. I remember Stockwell Day very well.
Uh-huh.
And, but I just was curious, is there something you could say about the nature of the state? And I think in terms of its capacity, in a general sense, as you look at the spread of intelligent design and creationism, in terms of the state's capacity to guide, for example, education, and control the media, etc. So I think now that I'm 6 years in the U.S., it's such a fragmented, for example, higher education system. In some ways, actually, a transformation in Canada, if certain political regime came in place, would be much easier because it's a provincial system, very little capacity for teachers to actually teach what they want. They have to teach provincially designed sort of curriculum, right? Whereas here, there's such fragmentation that teachers in Madison compared to Middleton, it's just, so actually, in some ways, might stronger state contexts in certain political, if certain political shifts occur, certain cultural shifts, might they actually enable this to spread much more quickly?
I'm sure that that's the case, but it's really hard to generalize. The number one creationist country in the world is the United States. As you say, just a crazy quilt pattern of jurisdictions for who decides. Sometimes it's the state, sometimes it's local school boards, counties, it's all over the place in the United States. The second country in the world is Turkey, which isn't Christian, is much more centralized in its educational system, and it seems to thrive there too. So I don't know that it's predictive in any way. Here, I think we can understand why creationism has flourished in the United States and why it's flourished in Turkey, but I don't see that we're going to move toward any good generalization about the role of the state, because it seems creationism seems to do well in many different environments.
Maybe one more question.
You have to decide. There have been several people with their hands up, and I'm biased now, and so you have to decide who goes last.
Where are the hands? First person, you stuck your hand up first.
So my question is about ID.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that intelligent design is a little more tailorable in some ways to people's individual beliefs than creationism.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that's the reason why it's been taken up by a lot of very eminent scientists, for example, Francis Collins. I don't know if you would consider him ID or not.
No, he rejects ID. I've talked to him personally about it. He is not an ID supporter.
So a lot of scientists actually see Francis Collins as an ID.
I know, but that's wrong.
So how is it that he's able to portray that image when he's not really an ID?
See, here's the problem, is that Francis Collins is an evangelical Christian who believes that you can see God in the genetic code. You can see evidence of God's work in the genetic code. The difference between Francis Collins and intelligent design people is that he thinks it's a crock to claim that's a scientific conclusion. As I was trying to insist, the main goal of the intelligent designers is not to point out all a natural theology to the evidence of divine design in the world. They claim they're not doing natural theology. It has nothing to do with theology. They are doing science in this. So if that is the big issue, if you agree with me that that's the big distinction, then there's no way Francis Collins is an intelligent designer, and he goes out of his way, if you ask him, to insist that he's not an advocate of intelligent design. And I buy that distinction. I think it's accurate in terms of the communities who subscribe. But you're right that there's huge diversity in the intelligent design camp. You actually have a few young earthers who manage to keep their mouth shut about the Bible while they're doing intelligent design. And then you